copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I'm going to explore a key passage in the Bible together. And I'm sure you have all come across references to Acts 17 in one way or another in the whole apologetics literature. So I did that as well, and that started my exploration into this whole area. And it occurred to me that it was really the most quoted passage, I think, in terms of apologetics. But it wasn't necessarily undergirded by serious biblical reflections. So it was often taken for granted what is there. That's always a bit scary, isn't it? And a bit frightening, you know, if you take a biblical passage for granted. Because there's a lot to discover there, and there may be some surprises when we move into the area. So I did my PhD on this specific topic. There was no exclamation mark behind it. Otherwise, it's the exact title of the... But I think it would be worth adding an exclamation mark so you think I'm somewhat affirmative in what I'm going to say to you. Anyway, I hope you all have all picked up the free books, which contains also a wonderful commentary on the Book of Acts by David Gooding, called True to the Faith. And the subtitle there is Defining and Defending the Gospel, I think it is. Isn't that interesting? When David Gooding, as a master of the Greek text, both of the Old and the New Testament, is going to summarize the whole message of Acts of the Apostles, the book, he writes, defining and defending the gospel. Which means then that the whole book is a book of apologetics. The whole book is a book of saying, why should someone believe in the gospel of Jesus Christ? And I'm sure you all recall that it's the second volume of a two-volume work, the first book being the Gospel of Luke. And if you also recall how the first book starts with a preface of four verses, and do you remember the purpose of the first book? Why did Luke write the gospel? He talks about that he's investigated those who saw it, the eyewitnesses. He's been exploring that. He's written it all into an orderly account. That's interesting. It's not necessarily a chronological account. It's an orderly account. To what? Remember? Anyone? Yeah.
To show the credibility.
Yes, and he then addresses Theophilus and to show the credibility. So the whole emphasis of the two-volume book is actually showing the credibility. And when you look at the book of Acts, that's the how God continues to work through his apostles. And it's helpful, I think, to look at it at three levels in terms of the credibility of the gospel. First of all, it's an account of how the road that the gospel message and messengers took on their way from Jerusalem to Rome, as it were, and beyond that. And then, secondly, on their way then, they encounter various worldview communities, various faith communities. They encounter Jews, they go into synagogues. They encounter Greeks in Lystra, in Athens, which we will talk about here. they encounter, straightforward paganism in a number of places, Ephesus and other places. They also encounter the occult, as you may recall. And they also encounter the question of what is and should the relationship be to the Roman Empire. The whole question of whether it's lawful or not. And I really love, we could have gone into that, but the first part of Acts 17, someone claims that you know, they are turning the world upside down because they are saying that another one is Lord. Isn't that a wonderful expression? Think of that, whether that could be said about our ministry, that we are turning the world upside down because we claim that another one is Kyrios, is Lord. That's quite an amazing, amazing statement, I find. So then, Acts 17, Paul actually entering into what was the, you know, the cultural center, the intellectual center of ancient times. Highly respected. Really quite small in terms of population, but a very prestigious place. And John Stott, which I do recommend his commentary. It's brilliant. He talks about what Paul saw, what Paul felt, what Paul did, and what Paul said. You can't really improve on that, can you? It's such a wonderful summary. What Paul saw, the idolatry. What Paul felt, the deep indignation. God is not given the glory. Then what Paul did, entering the marketplace, and then later on the council of the Areopagus, and then what Paul said in his speech. I think it's helpful, and I think in previous years we've had a good time engaging with the text, and I think it's important to look at it from one perspective. What is the text not? You know, what it's not, and not just what it is. Because there are a number of preconceptions about this text. And I've chosen to highlight four different... Of course I can. Hopefully, without breaking neither this nor your trust. I'm sorry. First of all, Acts 17 is not about Paul's appearance in a legal law court. Some people have taken the story to be a story about a legal defense in a court where Paul then is supposed to be accused and then defends himself. That is not the case. The Areopagus Council was not a legal court. It was a council that had some specific functions. And one of their functions was the following. If someone came into the city and presupposed them to be a herald of a god that wasn't present in the city, a foreign god, then that person would have to appear before this, you know, magistrate, this council, the Areopagus Council, and to present their case. For example, should a new altar be built or not? You may recognize some of these themes from Paul's speech. It's a lot about the altar and about Paul then stressing God has been here already. He's created everything. So it's not a legal court defense. It's an invitation as a herald of foreign gods to present his case before this council. That's the first thing we need to clarify. Secondly, in a number of books on missiology, you will find that people claim that this text is a missionary primer. It's a model for how to approach pagan people, you know, non-people without a scripture background. And there is some truth to it, but it's not the whole truth, at least. Because Paul's speech from verse 22 onwards is not his first appearance in the city. It's not his first speech in the city. It's actually a follow-up speech. It's a speech of clarification. It's a speech of engaging his interlocutors of various kinds. So we can look at it this way. Paul started in the synagogue, which is just briefly mentioned, then went on into the marketplace. And if you have ever read about the Athenian marketplace, ancient marketplace, it's quite a fascinating place because there a lot of things took place. It was a place for public debate. It was a place for public education. It was a place for leisure, sports. It was a place for, you know, meeting people, probably talking about gossip, which is touched on the passage as well. You know, they don't care about anything but the latest news, gossiping about that. Does that sound familiar to our age? Huh? So there, you know, a lot of things is going on. But Paul is then, first of all, presenting his message in the agora, in the marketplace. And what was his message there? He preached Jesus and the resurrection. First of all, that tells us how central Jesus and the resurrection was. Secondly, if you use the Greek words, it will be Jesus and Anastasia. Jesus is a male noun, Anastasia is a female noun. Aha! Here comes this strange Jew and seems to be telling about a divine couple, it seems. The male God, Jesus, and the female God, Anastasia, the resurrection. So Paul, again, has to clarify here. I'm sure many of you know the name N.T. Wright, Tom Wright. He seems to be writing his popular books using the name Tom and all the other books using the name N.T., about the N.T., which is fascinating. Anyway, N.T. Wright talks about, at least one place, about Paul in Athens is like a chess master. You have seen the chess master? I think there is actually a Norwegian chess master at the moment. Sorry about that. Or maybe I should be glad about it. He moves around. I've seen the chess master moving from one table to another, making a draw, and then moving on. You've seen that? I'm sure you've seen it. And that's a perfect picture of Paul going over to the Stoic, then to the Epicurean, then to the popular, the religious pagans, and then to the council and so on. And it's all intermixed. It's a very fascinating thing. There are many things going on at many levels here, because Paul was thoroughly trained in rhetorical technique and approaches. So we'll come back to that a bit later. But the point is, it's not the first speech he delivered in Athens. It's a follow-up speech. It's an apologetic speech where he engages with questions, objections, and worldview alternatives. Thirdly, it's not an isolated text. It's not a text that stands completely on its own, as if this is the place where Paul surrender to Hellenistic philosophy, and it's really not a very good text to think about. Some people have claimed. But if you look at it carefully, you have a number of parallels. You have a parallel to Acts 14, the Lystra incident. You have a very important parallel to three or four places in Paul's epistles. Romans 1, about the creation being witness to God's majesty and power. So it's about, the witness of God as a creator not leaving himself without traces. And the second chapter in Romans about the conscience being a witness to God's moral character as well. And then you have a very fascinating passage in 1 Thessalonians 1, where Paul is actually, I think it's verses 9 to 10, Paul is talking about how they came to faith. And this is written just after his visit to Athens, probably. And he talks about turning from idols to the living God to serve him. And if you look at the wording there, it's as if it is an outline of Paul's speech in Athens, really. It's a very fascinating. And then, of course, you have the passage in Corinthians about becoming Jew for Jews and Gentiles for Gentiles, about contextualization of the gospel. So it's not an isolated text. It's actually a text that stands in a very rich apologetic tradition from the Old Testament prophets through Jewish Hellenistic prophets in the two centuries before, through this passage and the other passages I mentioned, to Justin Martyr, if you've heard of him, from the early church, which really uses Paul's approach in his dialogue and polemics over against the pagan religion. Fourthly, it's not a mistake. This is something which appears in a number of more evangelical interpretations of the text. People feel uncomfortable about the philosophy. People feel uncomfortable about, it looks like as if Paul is becoming rationalistic, some people feel. But then we should not just think about what I've said already about the connections to various scripture passages, but also explore how the passage fit into the overall pattern of Acts, the book of Acts. There is, for example, exactly the same structure in verses 32 to 34. Some snared, rejected, others wanted to know more. Hoi men, hoi de in Greek. It's the same as in so many other places. Some rejected, some believed. Some didn't want to hear anything about this. Others wanted to pursue this further. So it's a very deep realism throughout the book of Acts about how it is. And some people say, well, there weren't that many that came to faith, was it? When did the number of converts decide about the content of anything? Can it be that it was so hard in a context that just sowing the seed is so demanding? So we must never, judge the authenticity of a message by the number of converts or the number appearing to anything. That becomes too simplistic and simply dangerous in many places. So this is a deeply biblically rooted passage in the Old Testament prophets. But Paul is a marvelous communicator, contextualizing. So these are four of the approaches that are unhelpful when approaching the passage. So maybe now it's appropriate to read the passage in chapter 17 from verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. And the word greatly distressed, it's the same word as it's used in the Greek Old Testament for God's anger towards idolatry. It's a very strong word. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace, the agora, day by day with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, what is the babbler trying to say? And the word babbler there is like the word for a bird that picks up little seeds. I know it is a figurative speech about this one is really not someone you have to take seriously. It's someone who is just a babbler. Others remarked, he seems to be advocating foreign gods. Well, it's almost true, isn't it? He advocated a foreign god, but not foreign gods. Why did they say that? They said this because, as I said, Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus. Let me explain. Areopagus, it's in the Ares, it's the name of the Greek name of the god of war. In Latin, it's used Mars, therefore you will meet Mars Hill, expression in many, many translations. And that council had given name, or had got its name rather, from the hill called the Ares Hill, the Mars Hill. So in this context, the council met both, sometimes at the hill, but more often in the marketplace. So I'm convinced the whole scene is in the marketplace. It's not up there. Therefore, it should never be translated. It went up, but it went before. Okay, that's a little parenthesis. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus where they said to him, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? You're bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean. And then there is this little narrative aside. All the Athenians all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. This wonderful irony from Luke here, you know. They prided themselves for being so intellectually superior. But what did they do? They were following the latest fashion, the latest ideas. It's really quite ironic. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious." The word religious has a double meaning here. It's a double entendre in a way. It's both affirmative. It's good that you're religious. But it's also the meaning of it is also you are superstitious. So you choose which meaning did Paul have. Maybe he had both. So it's an affirming and challenging at the same time. "For as I walked around and observed your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now what you worship as something unknown, I'm going to proclaim to you." Okay, here is Paul looking around and suddenly, "Eureka, I found it. I found an altar to an unknown God." Have you ever reflected on that? The altar has a number of functions there. The first function is that it refers to the fact that according to Athenian popular folk stories or folk tales, you know, the popular stories about the origin, as 500-700 before Christ, they actually were hit by a very serious disease. And there they wanted, you know, what have we done? This must be the judgment of the gods. So then they placed offerings to all the gods. But then it occurred to them, how do we know that we have offered to all gods? There may be someone we have forgotten. Okay, we have to build an altar to an unknown god. You know, that's a really a safety guarantee, isn't it? Insurance. So a kind of divine insurance policy from them, you know. Well, we need to safeguard. We mustn't forget anyone. So therefore, they built this. So therefore, immediately, for the Athenians, they would have thought about the judgment when Paul introduced this. That's one element. And as you know, probably remember, Paul comes back to the word, to the judgment as a very important theme towards the end. But there is also another dimension. If the unknown God is a real God, do you follow me? If the unknown God is a real God, what about the others? What about all the other gods, all the other altars, all the other... They must be idols. And this is actually the perspective of Justin, for example, when he encounters and uses this passage. He talks about that the altar to an unknown god is an implicit critique of all the other gods, because the other altars claim knowledge about God. This claims ignorance about God, which is a very honest thing, you know. And there's a longing here for, tell us more about this unknown God. And Paul actually says, now, what you worship as something unknown, I'm going to proclaim to you. That's a wonderful statement, isn't it? About Paul finding that specific point of contact in the whole Athenian context, which he's able to build bridges to, and it's like a bridgehead. But as I said, it functions as an implicit critique of all the others as idolatry. And then comes the speech. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by hands. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. Here is God as the transcendent God, the God, you know, beyond everything. But it's also God as the immanent God, God being close, giving life and breath to everyone. And here is the chess player, you know, affirming the Stoics' view of God or the gods as distant. There's some truth in that. And then in the next sentence, affirming the Stoics' view of God as some, you know, the immanent logos, the immanent cosmological principle, as it were. There is some truth in that. God is present. He is within, but he's also without. Very powerful. From one man he made every nation of men, that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he determined the times and set for them and the exact places where they should live. Okay. So this unknown God that has created everything, and is also close, he knew the Athenians. So the unknown non-God is not, the Athenians are not unknown to him. It's a wonderful way of introducing God as someone who really is present. You remember John Lennox this morning about Hagar? You know, about God being concerned about Hagar. One thing is Hagar's role in salvation history. Another thing is God really being concerned about Hagar physically, as John said, and spiritually. It's about the same thinking here, the same kind of affirmation. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he's not far from each one of us. So Paul is saying here, we are groping around in darkness. We cannot find God, though we search for him. But God is looking for us. So the direction is God's. God's grace, we heard this morning. You know, God has the initiative. He is the one who takes the initiative. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. So it's not just the temple that, you know, the altar, I mean, to the unknown God that affirms this, but even their own poets. There are at least some elements of truth in what they are saying. They are affirming their dependence on something more than themselves. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, okay, if we come from God, we should not think that the divine being is like like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. So if we are, as we would use, made in the image of God, God is not lesser than a human. He is not below a human. He is larger, bigger. You know, just to make a little pause here, when people talk about evil and suffering, for example, people often apply, or imply rather, that God's standards is really below us. Whereas it's the opposite. God's standard is beyond us. It's above us. In the past, God, being like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. And you may recall Isaiah 40 to 45, Jeremiah, you know, many of the prophets, it's exactly their critique of idolatry. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance. So God has shown grace overlooking it. But now, he commands all people everywhere to repent. And what is the evidence for that? For he has set a day when he will judge the world. Again, you know, judgment as a theme. With justice. God is to be trusted. God is the one who is not below our standards, but above our standards. He will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. Okay. The man he has appointed. Going back to the foreign gods question, who was Jesus? Well, he was a man. He was more than a man, of course, but he was a man. He has given proof of this to all men by raising him from the dead. It's a very strong word about the resurrection being the evidence of God interacting in history. And then comes the epilogue. When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, which of course was a controversial subject both for the Stoics and the Epicureans and the others, some of them sneered, but others said, "We want to hear you again on this subject." At that, Paul left the council. A few men became followers of Paul and believed, Among them were Dionysius, a member of the Areopagus, also a woman named Damaris, and a number of others. As you can see, there's a lot going on here. And I would like to summarize it, you know, because we're looking at from the point of view of apologetics, to summarize it as a five-part structure. And I've touched on all these already. Paul is actually... he's identifying and affirming points of contact. The altar being a very important point of contact, of course, but also the poets, for example. So, thinking about the model here, you know, as an apologetic model within the structure of, we talked about the structure of the book of Acts and the book of Luke as the two volumes, being concerned about the credibility of the Christian faith, we need always to remember that we need to identify and affirm points of contact. And then the question, of course, comes to us. What are the most essential points of contact in our culture? And then Paul moves from that into a three-part argument. The longest argument, the most developed argument in Luke's summary here, is the natural theology argument. And to paraphrase, one could say it in the following way. Every worldview is, in a way, a natural theology. It tries to explain the world, try to explain, you know, the cosmos, the universe, and humanity, purpose, meaning, truth, and so on. So here is Paul showing that the other worldviews that were present, Stoicism, Epicureanism, and so on, they did not have the same credibility when it comes to explaining the universe, when it comes to explaining who we are as humans. It's only the Judeo-Christian God who has the credibility to explain in his person and in his deeds, through his actions, the universe and humanity. So it's about God as creator, God as the author of life, the author of cosmos, the whole of life, and the author of humanity made in the image of God. And then Paul moves on to the second stage in his argument, and I find that very fascinating, because, and we can paraphrase this in the following way. Paul's point being, if God is the author of life, he has the authority over life. If God is the author of life, he has the authority over life. We are all familiar with, you know, copyright issues in our culture. And this is really the basic idea here, that the copyright belongs to God, the one who created all, who sustains it all, who is the one who sent Jesus, which Paul comes back to. So it's the author of life has authority over life. The ultimate authority belongs to one and only to God, the one and only God. And this, of course, relates to God's judgment, and then by implication to God's holiness, by implication to God's moral character. And there's a very important link between God as creator and sustainer and God as judge, as the one who has ultimate authority. And the third stage in Paul's argument is moving forward saying, well, the God who has now, in Paul's argument, being shown to be the one who explains the world and humanity much better than any other worldview. And by implication, if he does that, if he really is the God of the universe and God of humanity, the one and only God, he has authority over life. But is this God still unknown? No. He has shown his face. He has shown his name. in Jesus Christ, the man whom God has appointed. And I think there is something very significant about highlighting the resurrection in such a clear way there. Because that means both that, you know, the resurrection deals with death. Death is really the most ultimate challenge for us as human beings, you know, encountering death. It's the ultimate border, you know, the ultimate limit of our control. So actually, God is acting not in any distant area from where we are, really have our ultimate need, but at the very point that where our need becomes most obvious when we face death. That's the point where God meets us. So the whole question about the resurrection of Jesus highlights the importance of the relevance of that to the most ultimate questions in life, basically, fundamentally, facing death. And if we link that to, you know, what Romans and Corinthians, 1 Corinthians talks about, the wages of death, the wages of sin being death, then it becomes, you know, even more important. So first of all, why is the resurrection an indicator of a pointer towards truth here? Because first of all, it pinpoints the basic fundamental dilemma of our existence. We are moving towards death. Secondly, it highlights the uniqueness of Jesus. No one else has conquered death. He is the one and only Lord of life. So it's something fundamentally being said about Jesus. And of course, the Greeks had their ideas about death and the afterlife. And this was very challenging, as we can see to the reaction we read about. They're really, some snared, you know, this was too much for them. But some really thought maybe this is something worth exploring. And in our culture as well, I think, death. How do we tackle death? How do we treat death? That's a very critical issue, I think, in our cultures today. So we may come back to that in our discussion. So why is the resurrection highlighted? Because it's an ultimate question for us, death. Secondly, it really is indicating, showing, being evidence of who Jesus is. And thirdly, it's open for investigation. So it's not a blind faith. Again, going back to John this morning. Faith is not blind. It's the opposite. It's faith based on evidence. And with all this then, you know, Paul moves to points of tension, which is implicit in it all. You know, implicit in the three-part argument. Really, God or the idols. Who has authority? Ultimately, and who is the Lord of life? Ultimately, are we or is it God? Before opening up for discussion, may I just mention one thing that I think it's very helpful when you look at different expositions of this passage, that some expositors only emphasize points of contact, others only emphasize points of tension. I could give you an endless list of names. I won't bore you with that. But it's the secret to this passage is Paul, the master chess player, doing both. Affirming, challenging the whole time. Discussion?
I think that Luke's got in mind not a direct result of what he said that day, but as he stayed and reasoned and thought through.
Yeah, I think it's a result of an interaction with them. We want to hear more. We don't know how long time this elapsed, you know, really. But I think it's definitely an indicator of they wanted to know more. It's like a discovery group, you know, like an undercover group in UK or whatever. You know, it's really exploring together. And I think that shows maybe that very often it's a process that has to happen. Because there are so many things that people need to tackle, either intellectually or morally or deeply spiritually. And of course, it's a summary. It's a masterful summary. we need to keep open, you know, as you say, in this context, that the most, I think it's the most likely thing is that there were a period of time. We don't know how long, but a period of time. Well, if we go to the book of Acts, I'm more and more intrigued by some of the other passages, which really fit the same kind of basic pattern, but also relating to different audiences. For example, in chapter 26, when Paul is presenting his formal defense speech before the King Agrippa, and the final verses there, you may recall that I think it's Festus that opposes, saying, "You must be insane, Paul." And how Paul responds to that, that's very, very interesting. Paul responds by saying, "No, I'm not insane. But everything I say is coherent and consistent." Paul is actually saying that I've been thinking through this thoroughly. You know, he's been doing some serious reflection and thinking over time. And then he talks about, he appeals to, he says, well, this didn't happen in a corner. So he's talking about the history, you know. What happened with Jesus is actually open for investigation. There are eyewitnesses by implication. Then he turns to Agrippa saying, I know that you believe the prophets. No, which is a wonderful way of communicating, you know, say, you know, getting one of them over on his side, winning them very gently, but then seeing that, saying, it's not just a matter of internal consistency. It's a matter of corresponding with the facts and with the promises. The facts of history, and it's a consistency, coherence, correspondence with the promises of Messiah. And then he says something wonderful. There is, it's not much left until you become a Christian, Agrippa. So he talks about the transforming power of the gospel. It's like a magnetic power drawing Agrippa to Jesus, you know, to the message. So this relates to the three fundamental truth criteria, the criteria of consistency and coherence, the criteria of correspondence, and the pragmatic criteria. If it is true, it has to have consequences. So it's very, very fascinating as an example of another place where in the book of Acts, which has another audience, another context, but it's the same kind of moving from points of contact, affirming. And there are a number of places like that, but that's just one example. So I think there's an overall pattern we need to take seriously, which is the strength of David Gooding's exposition, which I mentioned, which we all have got or should have got. It's a wonderful, you know, listening to the overall structures. If you think of what John is doing this morning, he's sort of traveling back and forth, reading the patterns within Genesis and comparing it, you know, and drawing in the New Testament. It's a meta approach in a way, and not a detailed. Well, he certainly has wonderful observational skills, you know, when encountering the text, often so illuminating. I would say always so illuminating, maybe. But that's one example, and there is also another example in. Let's see. Rabbi Zacharias, you may be familiar with Rabbi's work. He has a wonderful lecture on this. I'm just trying to recall where it. I think it's 24. May come back to me. Yes, it's about the trial before Felix, I think. And how Paul then relates, Bill. There are some definite points of contact there that is affirmative. At the same time, it's deeply challenging. So again, it's this structure, I think, that we find all over the place. So it's worth reading with that in mind. Yes. Mm-hmm. I think you're raising a very important question about the spiritual reality, because this is really, you know, Paul in his inner being provoked, which is, I think, a good translation, greatly distressed, Paul then is so committed to God as the only and one true God that seeing all the idolatry really was hard for him. And you know, it's like, how do we react? And I think it's, as you say, it's challenging to stand up for truth in Europe today. It's challenging to be apologists. It's a wonderful opportunity, but at the same time challenging. So we need to be reminded, and maybe to go back to this and reflect on this for each of us, including myself. What does this mean for us? Are we ever provoked? Are we ever greatly distressed by anything, you know, spiritually, in our innermost beings, as it were? Or are we just so used to it all that it doesn't feel like we are engaging with it at any deeper level? And as I said, John Stott's exposition, which is really, it's in the Bible Speaks Today series, what Paul saw, what Paul felt, what Paul did, and what Paul said. But then, of course, how did Paul react to that? He reacted by reasoning, which is worth a lot of reflection as well. Which means that even though you have an internal feeling, it's not necessarily sufficient to communicate that feeling. You need to tell why is that important, you know. Yes, he had a background with Gamaliel and others, and he was highly trained. And he was trained both, you know, in the Jewish, deeply in the Jewish scriptures and all that implied, but also as a Roman citizen from Tarsus, with all that implied as education from there. So it seems as if he had this double training, this cross-cultural background, which in itself is fascinating, you know, to think about. He moves beyond from one context to another, not compromising, but contextualizing. So I do think his Jewish background is very evident in the whole idolatry critique, which is sophisticated and not simplistic when you think of it, because it concerns, is God lower than us or higher than us? And that really relates to, for example, naturalism. Then we make, you know, that worldview is really below us. It doesn't answer to who we are as humans, as an example. So I do think that his whole Jewish background, which you point rightly to, has a very key role to play. But then, of course, that was transformed through his Damascus experience, you know, through his whole and walking with the Lord. And as you probably know, 1 Corinthians 15 presents probably the earliest witness to the resurrection of Jesus in the New Testament. It goes way back to just a couple of years after Paul's conversion. He received this. And that's one of the very encouraging new discoveries in New Testament research, that this is a very old text. I mean, the content of it, the oral tradition behind it is very old. So he had his Jewish background, his Damascus experience, and then the teaching of the apostles like that transformed his thinking. So it's, there's a lot going on there.
Yeah. He's given proof of this before then. Mm-hmm. So how about now? Where does resurrection fit into the
Thanks for raising that. I do think, you know, I pinpointed three aspects to it. One was the relevance of the resurrection to the existential, deeply existential question of death. Yeah. And I think that's part of an answer to the, your important question and reflection is that is there anywhere else in the world of worldviews, religions, ideologies where we can find anything like it? In terms of answering to that. So if it is true, it is ultimately relevant.
Okay, yeah.
I think that's one important dimension, very important. Secondly, that it, you know, it shows the uniqueness of Christ. So it's not just relevant to us, to our ultimate questions or dilemmas of life, but it's also showing the uniqueness of Christ among everyone. I think the story goes of Tyrant, a very, anyone from France here? No. One of the ingenious politicians that managed to survive every change of government in France from revolution through Napoleon, through post-Napoleon. Try that and see whether you succeed. He was called Tyrant, and he got to question someone that wanted to start his own religion. And he said, well, that's no problem. I know what you would need to do. You know, was this very, you know, cynical, ironic person. Probably one of the reasons why he managed to survive. And he said, well, the only thing you have to do is just to rise from the dead afterwards. That's the only thing you need to do. Nothing more. Only. Sort of, you know, this sort of cynical man, but pinpointing really something very important about the uniqueness of Christ. And then it comes to the evidence. And I think if you look at, I haven't commented these arrows yet, but I think actually what you are suggesting here is that if people don't want to accept this, how do we then think about that?
I think you raised that in your paper.
Yes. So I think that's why this is so important. I think it's enough to say, if God is real, does he have, then he is the creator of life, creator of universe, and is he able to raise Jesus from the dead or not? Well, in principle, if there is a God, then he is able. And they're very fascinating. Some of the well-known authors in this area, like, for example, the Oxford philosopher Swinburne. Is it Richard Swinburne? Saying that really, he says to the whole New Testament establishment, you know, New Testament research, saying, you don't take philosophy seriously enough. Because in philosophy today, it's more likely, more reasonable to believe in God than not to believe in God, due to the revival of all the theistic arguments and you know, whole the philosophy of religion area. So he says it's more likely that there is a God than that there isn't, when you look at the whole field of that area. So if that is more than 50% likely, then the resurrection really becomes no problem intellectually, he says.
If you follow it through.
Yes, yeah. So, but then of course another point of would be to say that, okay, let's look at it from a naturalistic, or maybe rather an agnostic historian's point of view. Then you can investigate all the alternative theories and ask, do they explain what we do know? Because there are some things we do know. We do know that Jesus died. We do know that he was buried. We do know that someone claimed to see him. And we do know that Jesus, that the church, the church became a reality from some very frightened disciple. You know. So you can actually explore any and every option, saying, well, did the disciples steal his body? Did the Romans? Did, you know, the Jews? Or was it a hallucination? Or was it just a vision, objective vision? Or, and so on and so on and so on. It's not forcing anyone to believe, but what you can say, none of the alternative explanations have enough explanatory power. So at the least, you could say, we stand with an enigma, something we cannot explain. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because history isn't all of reality, is it? I mean, agnostically, history, you know, investigate from an agnostic point of view. There is more to reality than that. So I think it's perfectly legitimate to say that from a strictly agnostic historic point of view, if that is one's take on it, what one can say that none of the alternative theories, hypotheses, explain it at all. So we therefore stand with the question, we need to explain it anyway. Well, then we need philosophy about, is there a God? And then we need theology Well, the whole of the scripture and how that fits into the whole of the New Testament. And of course, N.T. Wright has written a magnificent book on this. And Bill Craig's writings are just very important. So, yeah. So I think you could actually tackle it on the existential level. This responds to, it speaks to our deepest needs. And I don't think we have really explored that sufficiently as evangelicals. We tend to move very quickly to the other issues. And secondly, about the uniqueness of Christ. And thirdly, about the evidential basis for our faith. Okay?
Yeah. I think that the most controversial point is that about the authority.
Thanks for that very important comment. I do think you're right. I do think that this is a real issue today. And part of it is, of course, that we live in a culture which is very egalitarian. To think about, you know, someone in authority is not popular. So then the question is, how should we think about power and authority? And I think I think there are clues in the text which you asked about, but there are also some other preliminary reflections one could offer. One is the difference between legitimate power and illegitimate power. And also the difference between the exercise of legitimate exercise of power and the illegitimate exercise of power. We cannot escape power. The question is whether it's legitimate or not. And we cannot escape exercising power. The question is whether it's legitimate or not. So, and if he is the author of life, then that's the legitimate reason for having absolute authority. I think that's the flow of the text. But if you go the other way, you know, some theologians have focused on the cross of Christ as being essential, and I think they're right in that aspect, as being essential in understanding the power of God. It's a power in weakness, you know. It's a power in... Luther talked a lot about that. Of course, I had to quote Luther coming from Norway. So he talks about the theology of the cross. So God's power, in a way, and I think is most evident as the most unlikely place, the cross. Seen through the empty grave, through the light from the empty grave. So I think it was Augustine that called the cross devil's mousetrap. You know, everything looked as if the devil had got the final word, but then he was caught there. That's a wonderful illustration of it's turning the tables. You know, it's showing on a cosmic level what seems to be an awful defeat turns into a wonderful victory. So I think the point in relationship to the ultimate authority is that the one who, on the one hand, the one who has authority, Paul claims, has a right to that because he is creator. He's the author of life, has authority of life. The whole question of copyright, which I mentioned. And the other dimension is the one who has authority hasn't remained distant, but has actually suffered through his son. So the theology of the cross shows in the most personal way that God is not a distant God. You know, God is not like the Buddha, the lotus position, you know, where you sort of close your eyes, and you, the point is to keep suffering, you know, keep it external, and to escape suffering. But here, the Son of God takes our sins upon Him. And you know, God showing His power in weakness. 1 Corinthians 1 and 2 is very important there. And if I may add, 1 Corinthians 2 is important to understand correctly, because it's often used as an argument for saying this is was a mistake. But actually, it's more about Paul looking forward. You know, he moved from Athens to Corinth. You may recall that from chapter 70 to 18. And it's really when Paul is faced with Corinth and all the immense challenges, he makes the decision, I mustn't trust anything but the transforming word of God. So it's he repudiates rhetorical skills for the rhetorical, for the sake of them in itself. You know, it's not a tool in itself. So he is very anti-sophistic in his approach. He's not anti-intellectual, but anti-sophistic.
Point of contact with everyone in the modern world, every person we meet, the point of contact is everyone makes claim to an ultimate authority.
Yeah, that's right. That's very important. Thank you, Andrew. It's, you know, because faith, everyone believes. The question is in what and why. So I love the expression from a Norwegian atheist. He says, I have an atheistic faith. That's very honestly put, you know. Few atheists are that honest, but he was really honest saying there is a faith, this faith operation going on in my life as well. So the question is then if the faith is sufficient, the object of faith is, if faith is sufficient or not, if it's credible or not. Going back to, you know, the natural theology, the different pictures given by each and every worldview about cosmos and about humanity. Okay?
Thank you very much. Awesome.